Good afternoon, everyone. I guess the first thing I would like to do is get a sense of who is here. I went to UIS. I know that when it rains, everything shuts down, and people just find a dry spot somewhere. How many people here are connected to Campus Crusade in some way? Work with, part of the group, attend meetings. Okay, so most people. All right.
Okay.
See, what I'm going to try to do is tailor what I'm saying to my audience a bit. One of the points of apologetics is to be able to present a defense to people who don't believe in Christianity, to show why Christianity is reasonable. But another side of apologetics is to be able to help us as believers to affirm that what we believe is true. And is sensible and is valid. I was listening to that guy presenting on a topic similar to this, who was saying that before he became a Christian, he thought Christians were pretty dumb. And then he became a Christian and realized that some Christians are pretty dumb. But then some unbelievers are pretty dumb too. Yeah. So he realized that we don't necessarily always think through our beliefs or look at them in comparison to other things that people say. So sometimes we do hold our beliefs for pretty dumb reasons. And that's possible, especially when you're in a society or you're coming from a context or a familial context where most people believe what you believe. Sometimes when that happens, you don't question what you've been taught to believe at all. So a part of the role of apologetics is to help us to think through what we believe and come to the place of recognizing that, wait, God actually really is very smart and Christianity actually is really very sensible. A couple of weeks ago, I was over by my church and I went and bought lunch and I bought some chop suey. And, you know, Joseph, who's sitting here, had recommended it to me. He said, the chop suey is great, try the chop suey. So I went and I bought it and I had it. And I thought it was great. So a friend of ours came in a few minutes later after I'd finished eating and she was complaining that, boy, you know, I'm hungry, I should get some lunch. So I said to her, well, I just had chop suey. You should try it, you know. Go by Mr. Reed and buy some chop suey. And her reply to me was, taste is subjective. And I don't really know if our taste buds are similar. It struck me because I was in the midst of starting to get my thoughts together for this presentation. And I was like, wow, that's brilliant. That's perfect. That captures a part of the essence of what I want to talk about. You see, that's a completely reasonable thing to say about chop suey. But can we say the same thing about truth? Is truth a matter of taste? Can I pick my own truth the way I pick what I'd like to eat for lunch? Is truth relative? Perhaps it would be helpful for all of us if I delineated two types of truth. Subjective truth and objective truth. Subjective truth is dependent on internal or personal preferences and changes according to our preferences. So, whether the chop suey is good or not is a good example of subjective truth. I thought it was really good, so for me it was delicious. My friend was completely right, though, to question whether she would think that also, or whether it would be true for her. So that's essentially how subjective truth works. Further, notice this about subjective truth. I might start to eat my meal of chop suey, really like it a lot, and then halfway through just start to dislike it. And then it would no longer be true that I find it delicious. So subjective truth is easily changeable. Today I can like a person and tomorrow I can dislike them. Objective truth, in contrast, is based on external realities about the world and the universe that we discover, which cannot be changed by our internal feelings. So an illustration of objective truth using chop suey then would be, an objective truth would be whether the meal I was eating had E. coli or not. Now, when I was on campus, I noticed that anybody who studied parasitology got very paranoid afterwards. You know, they go into the class feeling pretty fine, and they come out afterwards saying, you really putting your hand there? And things like that, like, you're going to eat that? Because they learned way too much, you know, there's such a thing as too much knowledge. So, you know, they realized just how dangerous this world is, and everything became a problem. But, you see, the truth is, if the chop suey has E. coli, it doesn't matter whether I believe it does or not. That reality doesn't change based on my preferences in terms of whether I like the meal or not. You can test for the presence of E. coli. And the bacteria works to make us ill based on scientific realities and not based on whether we want to be ill or not. So objective reality is different from subjective reality. So to begin to answer the question then, is truth relative? We can recognize that subjective truth is relative, but objective truth is not. To treat objective truth as if it's relative is dangerous, and it could quite literally get you killed. In fact, when we see people doing that sort of thing, we tend to think they're mentally ill. You know, if I go up on a tall building and I'm about to jump off, you know, we don't tend to think that I will fly if I prefer the option of flying over falling to my death. That's not how we deal with objective truth. We need to recognize objective truth, otherwise we could get ourselves in trouble. So the question that we're considering then, this question of is truth relative, is really important then. Some truths are relative, subjective truths. Some truths are not, objective truths. There are consequences for living as if objective truth is relative. You see, the thing is, objective truth is going to continue to be true whether we're aware of it or not, or whether we believe it is so or not. So going against it has real effects, because it is real truth in a real world. Those effects might be immediate, or those effects might be eventual. There's some practices like smoking that have eventual effects if you keep doing them. So some people smoke and think, well, smoking is clearly all right because I don't feel bad. You know, that's not how it works. There's an objective reality about what inhaling smoke does to your lungs. It's just that it takes some time to work, unlike gravity, which works immediately. So it's important then for us to know what truth is objective, so that we don't treat objective truth as if it's subjective and then face the consequences of doing so. But before I travel any further in that direction, I think it's important for us to ask whether this topic is relevant for us and for the people we interface with. Is this issue of relativism an issue in Jamaican and Caribbean societies? Or is it this kind of North American, you know, maybe Canadian, maybe European and Scandinavian issue? You know? Because generally in a philosophical sense, their societies are more liberal than ours. So maybe it's just for us an academic issue. I was thinking about that, and I realized there are at least two areas in which I see relativism becoming prominent in this society. The first is how people have started to respond to religious claims of truth. What I've noticed is that an increasing number of people will say things like, you know, I have my own thing. Or, oh, I'm happy for you, you know, I'm glad that's working for you, you know. Or, that's good for you, but it's not for me, you know. So, in the past, maybe, in sharing the Christian faith, you'd meet people and their response would be, well, you know, yeah, I just don't believe that. Yeah, I'm not convinced by those claims. Increasingly, though, I talk to people who are like, whoa, that's wonderful. I'm happy for you. As if this has absolutely nothing to do with them. And that, to me, is a response of relativism. I remember about 10 years ago, I was sharing with a friend of mine who I went to high school with. We had a reunion, and so we're on the bus coming from Niguel, and we had a lot of time to talk, and you know, I was hoping for an opportunity to share my faith, and we got to talking, and eventually I felt like the right moment came along, and I was sharing about my faith. And she kind of looked at me, and she smiled, and she was like, whoa, that's great. That's great for you. Yeah? And I'm thinking, wait, did you miss what I was saying? Did you miss, you know? Because the proper response to what I'm saying to you is not, that's great for you. I'm making claims which are true for everyone. I'm making claims about the world, the nature of the world, and about God, which affect you. It can't be great for me. So if we were talking about ice cream flavors, then sure, chocolate might be great for me and vanilla great for you. But all major religions claim exclusivity and make a claim to having exclusive truth at some point in time. So to respond with this sort of, that's nice for you, I'm happy you're happy, is relativistic. It suggests, in fact, that the same idea can be true for you and false for me at the same time in the same way. The second issue is a rather more touchy one. It's how people respond to issues of personal morality. A couple months ago, a prominent former beauty queen and personality announced to the nation that she was pregnant and she's carrying the child of this DJ. You know, and of course, you know, any such announcement is going to have, you know, people reacting in very different ways to it. Some people were very harsh and, you know, very condemning of her. Other people were very embracing. But one common reply in all of that is to say, well, that's her business. But you see, if you're asking a question of whether it's right or wrong to be having sexual intercourse outside of marriage, that's not an adequate reply. You can't answer that question by saying that's her business. That type of response is a relativistic response. The issue I'm dealing with right now is not even whether it's right or wrong to have sex outside of marriage. My issue is with the notion that each of us gets to decide whether it's right or wrong for us. That relativistic notion. You see, what it suggests is that there's no objective moral truth in this area. It's subjective. So my contention is that's her business just does not answer the moral question that's being raised. It sidesteps the moral question and avoids it. Both of these areas, this notion of religious truth and a notion of moral ideas and whether there is moral truth, in which I find we're becoming increasingly relativistic, expose some important and some fairly recent changes in the way people in the Western world see the world. So I want to go through a couple of those changes and just paint a picture for you of what the world is becoming. The rise of secularism has resulted in a generally held view that religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. Therefore, society should not be shaped by religion. Humanists believe that we can maintain morals and values without any moral authority or guideline except those that we choose for ourselves. And as a result, we're now open to almost any view on any topic. What's interesting, though, is that the rise of secularism has resulted in a loss of shame. Behaviors that in the past people would have hidden, they now parade in public. Another aspect of this trend is the rise of multiculturalism. Western societies, of course, as you realize, are made up of people from diverse backgrounds with very different belief systems about everything. I remember in prep school, one of my close friends was Hindu, and we had a good relationship, you know, and we would talk a lot, and I learned a lot from him. And one of my wife's close family friends is Muslim now, so I was with him the other day, and we were chatting. And, you know, you live among people who believe very, very different things from you. And diversity is not a bad thing by any means. In fact, I really appreciate culinary diversity. I think that's one of the best parts of living in the West. The fact that you can sample food from almost anywhere in the world and just figure out what you like and taste things you'd never necessarily think of cooking for yourself. And in a lot of ways, that type of diversity makes our lives interesting. The issue I'm highlighting then is not diversity itself, but the more recent attempts at figuring out how we can live together. So I'm going to quote Dr. John Patrick, who writes very well about this particular issue and brings some of the aspects into clear view. He says, multiculturalism claims to allow disparate groups to live together peacefully. However, in its more radical versions, multiculturalism is paradoxically culturally homogenizing because its solution to religious diversity is to exclude the influence of different religions from the public square, making religious-based tenets merely personal belief systems that are not allowed to contribute to political and social development. In other words, whatever you want to believe about morality, about God, about why we are here, about how we should behave, that's nice for you, but just don't bring that into the public space of discussion. We need to keep those things out, because if we can successfully keep those things out, we won't have people bombing each other. So it's an attempt to harmonize the world by saying, well, you know, we love the fact that we all are different, and we love that by just not paying attention to those differences and not discussing anything from the frame, from the framework of those differences. So what's happened then is the privatization of religion. Western societies want to be secular and to remove notions of religion and God from how we organize ourselves. So then the issue is, what do we do with all the religious people? Because there are lots of religious people in the West. So what we do is say it's okay to believe what you want to believe as long as you keep your beliefs to yourself. But here's the irony of that. Secularism itself is a belief system. It makes assumptions about the same areas of truth that religion speaks to, questions of absolutes, of the meaning of life, and of the nature of things we cannot see. So this then is the world in which we are asking the question, is truth relative? Now here's the thing. If you buy into secularism and into radical multiculturalism and privatization of religion, then any claims, any religious claims or claims of objective moral authority must necessarily be relegated to the space of subjective truth. After all, there's so many perspectives on these things. This world is a diverse place. How can any reasonable person believe in any objective truth when it comes to morality and religion? I mean, and the typical argument is sort of, well, you know, when it comes to morality, well, look at that tribe on the other side of the world. They don't believe the same things are wrong as we do, you know. Look at this other culture over there. They're so different from we are. How can you then claim that there's anything called an objective moral truth? Clearly, it's all just determined by context, by conditioning, by cultural variables. Further, the challenge comes because these things we're dealing with, the reality of God, the reality of moral truth, are not tangible things. Nobody expects to be exploring some distant mountain or to fly into space and turn a corner and meet God. Neither are you expecting to be digging in the earth and find where moral truth was written down and where it came from. Because these things are intangible, people tend to think that because that's the reality of them, that means they're not fixed. You know, we can't touch them, so then who can say what they are? So surely this is a subjective area, isn't it? Here's what's interesting. This way of thinking, in this relativistic way of thinking, is a part of the space of church also. I'll give you two areas in which I've seen it. I sat in a Bible study a couple years ago, one that at the time I was sitting in it, I was visiting. It was a Bible study I used to attend some years before that. So there were newer people there who I didn't know and some of my old friends. And I listened as a woman, you know, laid out her view on Christianity and other religions. And as far as she was concerned, you know, she can't see why the honest Hindu, the passionate Muslim isn't also going to heaven, you know. Because surely they believe what they believe because they were taught it in their culture, you know, and this is what they grew up believing. This is all they know, and they're earnest and honest in their belief. So surely, you know, they're just as right with God as we are. What she was not doing was actually paying attention to what the Bible says. You know? So relativism allows you to extract ideas you like from something and reject ideas you don't like. Another area in which it affects us in church is biblical interpretation. These days, nobody likes saying to anybody, you're wrong about that. Because, you know, of course, you know, we all have the Holy Spirit. You know, we're all intelligent people. We all can interpret scripture. So, you know, you might disagree with an idea, but it essentially becomes a flavor. So, you know, that's what you get from that passage. This is what I get from that passage. Even if they're mutually exclusive and can't work together, we're not willing to say, no, I think that's wrong. And here are my reasons for saying that's wrong. And a part of that is just this spirit of relativism that's floating around that makes us think, well, maybe what's really bad is to disagree. You know? And so we need to maintain a unity that comes at the cost of truth. But you see, when you view relativism from this kind of emotional perspective and also from seeing the kind of where you think about the unreasonability of claiming an absolute in a world which is so diverse, I can see why it would seem such a reasonable thing. But you see, the reality is relativism does not work. And there are many problems with it. So, what I want to do then is go through some of the issues that arise when you start to think through and analyze a relativistic framework of thinking. And then after that, I will look at some of the underlying assumptions that empower relativism. In the first place, relativism does not work logically. I'm borrowing here from R.C. Sproul, an article on pluralism and relativism. He says, if everything is relative, then the statement, everything is relative, is also relative. It cannot be trusted as a fixed truth. All statements become relative. All axioms become relative. All laws become relative. Relative to what? To other statements, which are also relative. We have infinite relatives with no ultimate reference point. We have millions of children with no parents. And you see the point he's making. To say everything is relative is to claim an absolute truth. So then you contradict the notion that everything is relative. So it doesn't work as a logical statement. Think about this in the space of religious ideas. It's either that we are living in an endless cycle of death and reincarnation, or that we are not. The notion that we have one life and then we are judged by God at the end of our life, which is what the Bible teaches, is not compatible with the notion of reincarnation. They cannot both be true because of the law of non-contradiction. Now, the law of non-contradiction is basic logic, but very, very useful logic. We follow it intuitively. We in this way, we say, well, if the lecture is going on, then the lecture cannot be going on at the same time. Follow that? In other words, if I'm speaking right now, then I can't not be speaking at the same time. It's one or the other. The law of non-contradiction states that something cannot both be true and not true in the same way at the same time when dealing with the same context. So, alright, so water can be, or H2O can be in the form of ice or steam, but not the same particle at the same time. It's one or the other. The chair in my living room right now cannot be made of wood and not made of wood at the same time. It can be made of wood and other things, but it can't be made of wood and not made of wood. You follow what I'm saying? So, this is intuitive for human beings, the law of non-contradiction. In fact, without the law of non-contradiction, we can't do anything. We'd be trapped in a mental box that doesn't allow us to do anything because there's no reality that we can hold on to. So, the first reason relativism is unworkable is because it denies this basic law of logic. If you're going to be logical and consistent, then you have to reject the view that all religions are essentially equal, all lead to God, and all are true within their own right. That makes no sense, especially because you have to hold the exclusive claims of Christianity, for example, as true while holding the contradictory exclusive claims of Islam as true also. So Islam, for example, and there was talk about this recently, I read an article that was pointing out that the Quran teaches that Jesus was not crucified and died. You know? So they say, yeah, he was tortured and he was put on the cross, but he was taken down while still alive and went on to live out his life. You know? No, that cannot be true while at the same time it being true that Jesus died for my sins. That doesn't work. Islam is claiming one thing, Christianity is claiming another thing, which is contradictory, so we cannot treat both as true. So that's one way in which relativism fails. But there's a lot more. I want to focus on moral relativism for a bit. Moral relativism essentially suggests that moral ideas are preferences, much like our taste in ice cream. They're subjective truths. We can't argue about them any more than we can argue about chocolate versus vanilla, even though I have argued that. But, you know, we do that. We argue about things we can't argue about. But deep down we know that, all right, chocolate cannot be objectively better than vanilla. I know I'm offending some people now. I know some people are saying, no, chocolate is objectively better than vanilla. But you see the point I'm making, you know. We start to treat morals in this way as if it's flavors. Your flavor versus my flavor. In contrast, absolutists hold that moral rules are frequently self-evident in the same way that mathematical truth is self-evident. In other words, we recognize what's morally right because we start to see it and we see it working in a certain way. It's intangible just like math is intangible, but it's just as real. As Christians, we hold that the reason moral truths are self-evident is that God has imprinted himself on us through our consciences and through what's called judicial sentiment. Our conscience tells us when we do something wrong. Some people have tried to suggest that your conscience is simply simply formed by socialization, but nobody's been able to come to that conclusion. And they can't explain why, despite diversity, there's a great deal of uniformity in the things we see as wrong across the world. Further, we have what's called the judicial sentiment, which is conscience has to do with when I do something. Judicial sentiment has to do with when somebody does something to me. In other words, you're wired to know when somebody's done something wrong to you. You don't need to tell a child that. The wiring isn't perfect because of sin, but generally speaking, you don't need to tell somebody, boy, they shouldn't have done that to you. You feel it. So these things are the evidence of the imprint of the image of God on us. So what that means is that we don't invent morality. We discover it, sort of like we discover multiplication tables. Notice this, though. Relativism as a moral system seeks to redefine what it means to be moral by measuring it by a new standard. Now, the classical idea of morality is this, and it has three characteristics. Morality has been viewed as a supremely authoritative guide to action, trumping considerations of preference, taste, custom, self-interest, and individual fancy. In other words, classically, we understand that what is morally right is not necessarily what I want. And morality serves as a guide for me to reject what I might want to do in a moment and do what I understand to be right. The second aspect of it is oughtness. Morality tells us how we ought to behave. What's interesting is that when you get naturalistic, in other words, when you treat the world as if, you know, everything needs to be observed and understood and measured in terms of a scientific phenomenon, you can't explain oughtness at all. There's no basis for anyone thinking we ought to behave in a certain way. There's no process in nature that oughtness emerges from. The third characteristic is this: the universal nature of moral rules. In other words, what is right in Jamaica is right in Denmark from a moral standpoint, not a legal standpoint, no. From a moral standpoint, what is right in Jamaica is right in Denmark, and it would be right even if we took a colony to Mars. That's the classical understanding of morality. Relativism, however, rejects all universal moral rules and abandons the idea of oughtness. This is not universal, and there's no way we ought to behave. This thinking is based on an important but often unstated assumption: moral neutrality. I'm going to spend a little while here because this is a really important concept to understand. Moral neutrality is the notion that there is such a thing as a morally neutral ground, a place of complete impartiality where no judgments nor any forcing of personal views are allowed. Each takes a neutral posture towards the moral convictions of others. And this is the essence of tolerance, as the argument goes. But the question is there such a thing as moral neutrality? Is it possible to be morally neutral? Here's the rub. The problem with moral neutrality is that the view itself is not neutral. It is a positive position. Let me see if I can break that down for you. Moral neutrality essentially means that all views are equal and worthy of the same respect. I'm sure you've heard that type of thing. You know, the idea that, boy, what everyone believes about the world, about God, about morality is equally valuable, you know, and we should respect everybody's perspectives. And that sounds good on the surface of it, doesn't it? And it naturally leads to the conviction that no one should impose moral ideas on another person. But you see, that's not a neutral position. That's a positive position. It's prescriptive of how others should behave and implies right and wrong, better and worse. To say that is to take a moral position about the issue, and to say that to do otherwise from that belief is wrong. In other words, what becomes wrong now is not to treat all views as equal. What becomes wrong now is to seek to impose your views on another. Therefore, the notion is not neutral. It's a positive position. It is making statements about what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong. Those who hold to the view of moral neutrality are in fact saying that their position is correct and that others should change to agree with them. Further, suppose I disagree with the view that all views are equal and worthy of the same respect. Suppose my view is that all views are not equal and not worthy of the same respect, and that mine is right. Then is that view also equal and worthy of the same respect? This is where the remixing of the notion of tolerance starts to break down. In practice, the new synthesis of tolerance is tolerant only of those who agree with its core tenets. If you disagree, you are labeled ironically as intolerant, and you will not be tolerated. The new tolerance says we should respect the point of view of others and defines that respect as keeping any disagreement to yourself and embracing the validity of all views. It implies that to do otherwise is less than intelligent, virtuous, and charitable, and it will not tolerate such a point of view. So the new tolerance is astoundingly intolerant of views which oppose it. So here's what it comes down to. Relativism, ironically, is an absolute position. It will embrace you as long as you don't disagree with its absolute tenets. What is preached as tolerant is only tolerant of those who don't disagree with them. The reality is that everyone has a point of view and they think they're right, but moral relativism is pretending that it doesn't have one. Next set of criticisms of moral relativism. I want to point out there's a couple of flaws that come with the space of moral relativism. I'm borrowing some of this material from an article by a guy named Gregory Kukul. We'll put it up on our site when we put up this presentation, so you can go through it for yourself. He points out 7 serious flaws that come with moral relativism. I'm only going to highlight a couple of them. First one is this. Moral relativists can't actually accuse anyone of wrongdoing. You see, you can't criticize somebody's behavior because, according to moral relativism, there's no such thing as wrongdoing. It's just another flavor that somebody else likes. So you're free to dislike somebody's behavior, but you can't actually say it's wrong, and you have no basis for making such a claim. So what this means then is that a moral relativist has no basis to take issue with some of the recent incidents we've had in Jamaica, like the multiple rapes, the vigilante justice, just over the past week plus. There's no basis for taking issue with that. That's just somebody else's flavor. That's just what they want to do. When right and wrong are a matter of personal choice, we surrender the privilege of making moral judgments about the actions of others. However, if we are certain that some things must be wrong and that some judgments against another's conduct are justified, then relativism is false. In other words, we have an instinct towards recognizing right and wrong. We recognize it through our conscience, we recognize it through the judicial sentiment. It's not simply a product of culture. We are personally affected when certain things are happening. We are disgusted by some things. There's a powerful response to evil in us. That may not be uniform for everyone, but for people who lose that response, we have names for them. We call them sociopaths. We call people in our society who lose their sense of what I ought to do and think they can do anything they want. We actually think they should be on medication, or at least locked up and kept away from everybody else. Another flaw with relativism is that relativists cannot make charges of unfairness or injustice. It's related but slightly different. You see, under relativism, the notions of fairness and justice are incoherent, as both concepts dictate that people should receive equal treatment based on some agreed external standard. However, relativism does away with any notion of external binding standards. Justice entails punishing those who are guilty of a misdemeanor. But under relativism, guilt and blame do not exist. If nothing is ultimately immoral, then there's no blame and therefore no guilt worthy of punishment. So, we end up in a world where justice just falls down as a concept that's workable. Because who are you to say that what I did was unjust? On what basis do you make such a judgment? The only thing you can have is an agreed societal consensus which is decided by those who have the most power. Because there's nothing to govern those who have the most power anymore. There's no principle that is higher than power anymore. Power becomes ultimate, and those who are powerful set the rules they want and enforce those rules through laws. So, ultimately, there is no justice. And there's no appeal to anything called justice. You can't go into a regime like that and say, you should be just. Because there's no such thing. Thirdly, relativists can't complain about the problem of evil. The reality of evil in the world is one of the first objections that people tend to raise, especially to us apologists, when you know they're trying to dispute the existence of God. They say, well, if there is a good God who's all-powerful, how can there be evil in the world? Why is there evil in the world? But you see, the objection itself hinges on the observation that true evil exists. Objective evil cannot exist if moral values are relative to the observer. In other words, we cannot say that somebody did something evil if there's no such thing as an absolute standard by which you can judge good versus evil. It's just a flavor again. Hitler had his flavor, I have mine. So really, for relativists to be consistent, they need to surrender the concept of true evil. And ironically, must also surrender the problem of evil as an argument against the existence of God. When you look at where relativism leads us, what you begin to realize is that relativism actually goes against all our instincts about what is good and right and desirable in the world. One more thing I want to go through with you. And in doing this, I want to link to the claims of the Bible. Because in thinking about it, I realized that there's a worldview which empowers relativism. You'd wonder, if you think of it from a logical standpoint, how anyone could think this way. But you see, there are aspects of who we are, this thing called a worldview, which are assumptions we've made about the world around us and how it works, which actually allow us to do all kinds of gymnastics in our mind, to keep pushing towards what we think is worthwhile. So, what are the assumptions underneath relativism? I've discovered at least two. One we've seen already. It's the assumption that when it comes to religion or spirituality, there is no truth. Or the notion that we can't actually know moral, religious, or spiritual truth since it's intangible. Now, naturalists fall into this trap quite naturally. We only have beliefs. And all views are therefore ultimately legitimate. Here's the thing though. The Bible is at odds with this view. Jesus says of himself that I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man can come to the Father except by me. Ultimately, truth is not just a concept. Truth is a person. Jesus is the embodiment of truth. He actually doesn't conform to the rules of truth. He writes it. It's an expression of himself. Truth is Jesus' self-expression. That's why when Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, talking to Jews, including Pharisees, he points out to them that, you know, really, you're of your father, the devil, because he was a liar from the beginning. You know, and he contrasts himself to them, and he says, well, if you're of the truth, you'd obey me. In other words, he's pointing to almost a genetic link between truth and himself, and saying that if you believe truth, you're going to believe me. It's not a question for him. It's not an issue of flavor or opinion. He's saying that people who love truth and recognize truth run to him. Because they recognize him as the owner. So, in making a world then, the world he made reflects his nature as being true. Hence we have laws of nature. Hence we have laws of morality. They emerge from him. The second assumption that empowers a relativistic mindset is the idea that the real problem that we have as human beings is our need to feel or do better. Self-esteem or achievement or self-actualization, fulfilling our potential, chasing happiness, become the highest goals for the human being. Therefore, anything that meets this need is good because it works for you. The Bible is at odds with this idea too. Our real problem is sin and alienation from God. We feel guilty because we are guilty. And Jesus came to solve our problem. I want to read for you a quotation from Oprah. From Oprah Winfrey. Oprah, towards the end of her talk show career, was kind of trying to summarize some of the lessons she had learned over the years. And this is what she said. The show has taught me that there's a common thread that runs through all our pain and suffering. Unworthiness. We can all block our own blessings because we don't feel inherently good enough or smart enough or pretty enough. The show has taught me that you're worthy because you were born and you are here. Your being here and being alive makes you worthy. You alone are enough. I find Oprah fascinating. Infuriating also, but fascinating. What's fascinating about Oprah is that Oprah has almost found the problem. In all her years of talking to hundreds of people, she almost found the problem. The problem Oprah has is that she thinks the problem is how we feel and not how we are. The problem is that we feel unworthy. But she actually thinks we're worthy. So she's essentially saying, look, your big problem is that your feelings are not in tune with reality. The reality is you're unworthy. The reality is you're worthy simply because you're here. Your being born means you're worthy of receiving all of the good things, all of the blessings that could come your way. That's fascinating. I mean, it wouldn't occur to Oprah that maybe we feel unworthy because we are unworthy. You know, that maybe what's broken is not this thing that makes us feel guilt and makes us feel like we're not what we ought to be. But maybe what's broken is us. That's exactly what the Bible teaches. It teaches that we as human beings are fundamentally broken. And that we broke when our foreparents, Adam and Eve, decided that, you know, they wanted to embrace some relativism. So God had said certain things, and here comes the serpent to say, did God really say? No. When you eat of this fruit, you're not going to die. You know, in fact, you'll be enlightened. Your eyes will be open. And you'll have the knowledge of good and evil. And coming from a reference point of God as absolute truth, all of a sudden Adam and Eve thought, well, maybe God isn't true. Maybe there's something else out there for us, which is good. Because they were already experiencing good. But they thought there was more good to be had by disobeying God who was good to them. So they embraced relativism and they sinned and they fell. And we are shaped in their image. We carry the wounding that happened to them. The wounding of person and soul and intention and desire that happened to them. So we feel unworthy because we are unworthy. Well, a part of the uniqueness, and again when you're talking about exclusivity, of Christianity is that it claims we have a unique problem and it offers a unique solution. It doesn't give us rules to follow, even though Christianity does have a lot of rules, but we are not saved by following rules and guidelines. In fact, it says the rules are from a perfect God and you're imperfect and you can't follow them anyway. So the rules expose our brokenness. This absolute morality which God laid out and gave, you know, to the children of Israel, exposes who we are and the fact that we fall way below this standard. So here comes Jesus, and Jesus doesn't come to give us instructions to fix ourselves. He doesn't come to say, all right, you know, it's sort of like Buddha. You know, you guys are misguided, but I have enlightenment, and here's what you need to do. You need to do all of these things, and you need to work hard at them. Instead, Jesus comes to say, I've come to fix a problem you cannot solve. I've come to lay down my life to pay the penalty for your sin so that you can be restored to God and you can be forgiven. The problem we have is that we need forgiveness. And nothing else offers forgiveness. There's no other religion which offers forgiveness. A lot of religions offer you the opportunity to improve yourself. But they don't offer you the opportunity to have your slate wiped clean by God so you can be restored to Him. Before he was crucified, Jesus had a conversation with the Roman governor who was reigning in Israel at the time, Pontius Pilate. And Pontius Pilate was examining Jesus because the Jews had brought Jesus to him. So, essentially because they wanted Jesus to be crucified, but Pilate is the only one who has the authority to do that. So, he's having a conversation with Jesus, and Jesus is starting to respond to his questions. And Jesus says to him in John chapter 18, verse 36, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. Then Pilate said to him, so you are a king? Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? So Pilate, in the midst of his interrogation, decides to get philosophical. What is truth? What's interesting is that Pilate intuitively knows what truth is. He functions with it all the time in other ways. There's truth about the world around us that we function with. We drink water because we believe it's true that we're sustained by drinking water. You don't look at a glass of water and say, what is truth? You know? And then stop drinking water and die. You know? But Pilate is playing mind games here. What's fascinating is that Pilate goes on from this point to declare that Jesus is not guilty. After examining him, he says to the Jews, I can't find anything wrong with this man. Yet Pilate goes and orders Jesus' crucifixion. That incident points right to the heart of relativism. Relativism is a way of living where you can do what's convenient to you, even though you know what is true. You see, Pilate was going to be under pressure if he didn't respond to the Jews. The Jews were using every political ploy they could to get him to cave in to their request to have Jesus crucified. They told him that, boy, Jesus was opposing Caesar, and basically, if you do not oppose Jesus, it's going to look like you're not supporting Caesar, which a governor cannot do. He can't afford for that to happen. He could get replaced and killed. So Pilate now has to make a choice. He's under pressure from the Jews. He's under pressure from the people, from the crowd who are demanding Jesus' death. And what Pilate does is to sentence a man to death who he knew was innocent, and then say, I'm innocent. And that doesn't work. The heart of relativism is an attempt to evade the natural conclusions that come from realizing something is true. It may seem convenient at the time, but eventually, when we oppose the truth, there will be consequences. So, my hope today for you in presenting all of this is that you would not be quickly convinced by what can be very attractive arguments by relativists. And you'd be able to think, analyze for yourself, listen carefully to claims, and wrestle with the reality of absolute truth in these spaces of claims about God and claims about how we ought to behave. We live in a world where very soon the only thing that will be wrong is to say that something is wrong. And if you're a believer, you're going to have to stand against that. And you're going to have to stand against it not just in a personal way by holding personal belief, but by making compelling arguments for the reality of absolute truth. So, my hope and my prayer for you is that, you know, if you're not a Christian, this will pave the way for you to seriously consider the claims of Jesus and not fall into the trap of thinking that, well, that's nice for some people, but you know, that's not my flavor.